Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
What is one
Can I go get more coffee?
Yeah, you want to? You need to?
Do you mind if I do?
Not at all.
Are we allowed to interrupt? How will you edit this?
Through the magic of post-production. Do what you need, babe.
But what? Okay.
From 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball, this is the PBP Voices of Baseball. We bring you the people who bring you the game.
Welcome into the PBP. Yes, it's me, Matt Spiegel. It's funny, as we record, one of the biggest stories in baseball is about play-by-play. Kevin Brown suspended by the Orioles for giving genuine context about the team's newfound success in the division. Context that was provided to him by the team's PR staff in the game notes broadcasters are handed every single day. Just an incredibly absurd story. Others have spoken passionately about this absolute travesty all around the play-by-play community. And in next week's episode, our guest, Howie Rose of the Mets broadcast team, is going to get deeper into it. But let me just say this from my perspective. The Angelos family should have learned from what they did to John Miller nearly 30 years ago, and they have not. Peter Angelos at the time said he wanted someone who, quote, bleeded orange and black more. And like Peter's son John, now with Kevin Brown, Peter could not handle simply hearing the truth. Fans want the truth. No one is harder on a team than the fans, and they know when they're being lied to. That is true then when John Miller was fired by the Orioles, and it's even more true now. The Orioles have to live with the fact that they fired a broadcaster that most consider to be the living standard as the greatest to do this job. You're going to hear John Boog Shambi in this very episode reference and credit John Miller multiple times. And all of that comes under the header of San Francisco Giants broadcaster, not Orioles. More next week on this, but the beauty of the fans chanting "Free Kevin Brown" organically at Tuesday night's Orioles game is a testament to the foolishness and shame of the whole thing. All right. I love this episode. I love this conversation recorded at the man's house, and not the first time I've been there to Boog's house. So there's a comfort level, which is different. And I think you'll hear that. You know, those amazing podcasts where like the actors or the comics are talking to their friends and it feels like you're just hanging out with them. You know, those ones. I think maybe me and Boog got there. This guy is smart. He's funny. He's curious. He's earnest. He always wants to awaken everyone statistically. But thankfully, he also has a sense of humor about it. See if you can hear me sipping coffee out of one of Boog's mugs as we sit in the little library room at his house. You'll definitely hear me giggling as he tells us about the Marquee Sports Network television booth and his inquisitive partner.
So my partner, Jim Deshaies, you're familiar with his work.
I am. Big fan.
He likes to test the wind at Wrigley Field by throwing a Jim Deshaies baseball card out of the booth.
Which is amazing. I've never heard that as a thing that any analyst has done. He's got a big stack of his own cards.
That's correct. But he doesn't waste them. It's not a wasteful exercise. It's one a game, maybe two. So for the most part, they land right below us. And they come fluttering down and someone reaches for it. And then they look at it, kind of like it's raining frogs, and then they look back up at the booth, and sometimes we wave and sometimes we ignore them, and then that confuses them.
And what is he learning at this point? He's learning what the wind is doing right in front of the booth, but Wrigley's insane, so it could be going...
Matt, he's learning nothing. It's an exercise that's fun for both of us, and I enjoy it. Really have enjoyed it since year one. Anyway, so earlier this year, the Cubs are playing the Mariners. Now, JD, for the most part, it'll make it down below. Sometimes it'll make it to the lower level. That's one where you watch the people and they find the card and it freaks them out. They don't understand what's happening. Also, Taylor McGregor found a Jim Deshaies card by like a mustard dispenser on the concourse at one point. That's another story.
Yeah. I'm getting a real Magnolia Raining Frogs vibe here.
Yes. So anyway, that is the reference, by the way. So it's not the Bible. Okay, so we're playing the Mariners. It's the game that Kelnick hits one 7,000 feet. I think my home run call was just, oh. And the ball was flying. And so, unlike most games where he'll do it pregame, he decides to test the wind in the third inning. And it makes it onto the field in fair territory. And we are beside ourselves. He does it between innings. And we're like, what do we do? Should we show it? Are we going to get in trouble? If we show it, we might get in trouble. We can't put the camera on it. We kind of need to put the camera on it, though. How did it get all the way out there? That's amazing. And so we just keep talking about it. But we're not sure what to do. And then the game starts to go on. And then we forget about the card.
Because you're doing a ball game.
That's right.
There's six more innings.
We're busy. So post-game,
mm-hmm.
I get a text with a picture, and it's from Scott Service.
Be the manager.
The manager of the Mariners. And it says, hey, when I was going to take George Kirby out, I looked down just inside the foul line, and this was there. So I picked it up. I looked at it. I knew we were in good shape once I saw it was a JD card, and I put it in my pocket.
Why does he think they're in good shape at that point? That's fascinating.
I think they're former teammates. I think he was making a joke.
Oh,
like,
God. I made you explain it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. That is you. You had an effect on the game.
That's correct.
Is the way that it feels to me.
Yes.
That is a level of joy and comfort and, like, some terror, obviously, that goes on in the booth. So you're living a whole emotional life, as Boog shows me.
I screwed the story up. It was Logan Gilbert. It wasn't. Yeah.
I think, yeah, that's maybe a little better. Kirby, he's like, he loves that, his stuff. He's feeling even more secure.
Right.
Gilbert, he's a little worried, but then he's like, oh, there's JD.
Yeah.
There's my guy.
I'm good.
He's good.
Yeah.
Are you feeling free enough at this point in your career, having done this as long as you have, to have a full, like, emotional and kind of psychological experience like that, like the mechanics of actually doing the game and the muscle memory of doing the game? Is it comfortable enough where you're using, I don't know, 30% of your brain or 40% of your brain now, and you're free up to have a regular human experience? You know what I mean?
Ooh, that's a good question. I still, let me start with this. I would tell you, and God, people are going to be so tired of my act. One of the things I really love about the job on a day in, day out basis is that I get to use my brain.
Uh-huh.
I really like that part of it. You know me well enough.
Yes,
so,
yes.
I will tell you that as I've gone on, one of the things I appreciate about the job on TV, especially when I do radio, like it's almost 90, it's to do the job is kind of, it's like a mindfulness experience, because it's almost impossible to call play-by-play and listen to your partner and engage the conversation in the back of your head about, I have to do this when I get home, I have put on weight, I am going on a date later. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
So you have to be present. It demands it. And so it's like this gift that once the game starts and you're on the air, you're forced to be present, and it's great.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's been a theme on this podcast, is the mindfulness of it. And I can tell you, just by me doing it last weekend or 2 weekends ago or whatever it was, I turned off my phone. I mean, I'm sure you're to the point where you don't need to do that, but I was so nervous and green, I needed to do that. And boy, did that help with my forced mindfulness that
yes.
you're talking about. Yeah, you have to do that. The ball game as a gift in your personal life is fascinating.
Yeah, it's 3 hours where you're just being asked to be right there, that when you're describing the pitch where the ball is hit, it's just not possible to engage those other things, those other conversations in our head that we have during the day as we're checking out at Whole Foods or whatever, that as you're taking your stuff out of the basket, you're thinking, how much time do I have to get to work, and can I still do this? And you're someplace else.
Yeah, I wonder if that forced mindfulness is part of why people don't want to quit. You know, like on any level of association with it, having 162 times a year where you lock in and your friends and your family know, yep, you got a job to do. You're doing your job. We're all so interruptible in our lives. But
yeah, that's a good point. You're not very interruptible with that gig, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's part of it. I think that it probably just becomes so, the sport and the gig is so routine oriented. You're just, you know, I always used to say it's like, especially when you're doing the team thing, you're in a bubble, and the people outside the bubble can't understand it, not fully. And I mean to the point where the people that are on the plane, there's a shared experience and something about the experience that even their spouses can't get, because you're just doing it every single day. You know, I think the negative way to do it is, do you remember the old Dunkin' Donuts commercial where the guy's like, time to make the donuts,
yes,
time to make the, you know, you can get into that mode a little bit. And I don't like that. I try not to get into that mode. I want to, you know, it's today we play the Braves, you know what I mean?
Yes.
As opposed to time to make the donuts. I don't want it to be time to make the donuts.
That's probably dependent on how people are just as people, you know, like eventually,
yes,
like, are you someone who can find the joy and the curiosity in the seemingly mundane? Cause it's not mundane.
No. Hey, this is a really good part for me to ask if I can curse.
Yes.
Okay. And then, so, I mean, the two of us getting together in this setting, people not familiar with our work, but I mean, this is going to be for, somebody's going to end up in some type of like existential crisis at the end listening to this, because you and I are going to go so deep, and most people are going to finish listening to this like, you know, I thought I liked those two, but they're assholes.
They're assholes.
Yeah.
And
their act is so tired. It's like you're a talk show host and a play-by-play guy. Like, enough.
Oh, God. It's all about you guys. Yeah. My God.
That's right.
Yeah. Like, why would you think we're interested?
Yeah.
In
don't
that?
Care.
Jay Cutler has entered the chat.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's, look, so you just described a level of kind of involvement with the club that I've been trying to put a finger on throughout the whole thing. It's kind of like you're an embedded journalist, like in Vietnam, not to minimize a wartime experience, but like you're sent, you're in there with the soldiers in the trenches often, and you're traveling, but you're not really part of the fight. But you get to see stuff and follow up. Is there another analogy that makes more sense? Because when you're with a club, it's fascinating to me. Like, you are part of it. You're in managers' meetings. You're in the room.
Right.
You're talking. You're learning stuff. You're
and
knowing
your schedule
stuff.
Is their schedule.
Yes.
So it's the same. I don't know that I've come up with an analogy or metaphor that necessarily works. I will say this. I have a friend, for example, who has worked a long time on and off in the English Premier League. And he says to me, the baseball schedule is madness. And he has asked, and other people ask, how do you do it? You just do it. They're going to play today, and my job's to broadcast the game. So, like, you just have to, you know, in the same, to that extent, it's like the players as well, where they just get wired in a way where you just play.
Yeah.
So
somebody's going to play.
Yeah. Somebody's got to broadcast a game. So
might as well be you.
Might as well be me.
Yeah. You love being able to chase down knowledge, don't you? Like, where does that rank among your favorite benefits of the gig? Because you have a thirst for it and a freaking desire to know stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be high on the list of stuff you
Very.
Like.
Yeah, I think that it's the thing that's kept me so engaged over the years. You know, I tell people I still like this sport and I'm interested in the sport at the same level as when I was six. Legit. But the reasoning has changed. And so, yeah, I think that the quest for knowledge, but it's not like accumulating to... It's just because I'm genuinely interested. And then I also think it becomes a storytelling thing, something you can share with people. You know, we had a game last night, and just randomly, because I had done it a couple years prior, you know, like, look, not everybody's in on advanced metrics, and I like it, and I recognize that we got to be careful with how much we stuff down people's throats. But then the other part is, this is what's actually happening. That's my biggest, the biggest flag I put in the ground is, look, this is how they're viewing the sport, the people building the teams. So we can sit here and look at wins and RBIs till we're blue in the face, but they're not looking at that. So you're engaging in some fantasy world at this point. So anyway, I had a conversation a couple years ago with Mike Chernoff when the Cubs were getting ready to play the Guardians and Savali was pitching.
Mike Chernoff, president of baseball ops?
Yeah.
For Cleveland.
Their GM, Antonetti, is their president of baseball. Anyway.
There we go.
So in the middle of the conversation when I was asking him about Savali, because his peripherals were not great, I was like, is he real? Blah, blah, blah. And he stops himself in the middle of it and he says, wait, he's got a lot of wins, doesn't he? And at that time, he was leading the American League in wins. So he didn't even know. And I said, will you let me share that? You may not be interested in WOBA, and not that I drop that very much. You may not even like when we mention OBP, but I try to give you what the league average is. But the point is, you got to be at least a little interested in the fact that Mike Chernoff has no idea how many wins Savali has.
Absolutely. That's instructive,
right,
in terms of the way that the GMs think about it.
So last night,
uh-huh,
I text Carter Hawkins, who's leading our team in RBIs?
It's the Cubs GM, because Bellinger got his 51st last night.
Yes. And he sends me Hap? Nope. Swanson? Nope. And then he lands on Nico, and I'm like, would you be okay if I shared that? And he's like, sure. But he asked everybody in the suite, and Jed was the only one that knew.
Yeah.
But, like, again, it just – think about that for a second. Like,
sure.
The guy who is putting – and it's the way they're all doing it. It's the way they all do it.
There is an accepted – groupthink, and I don't mean that in a negative. Right. There's an accepted groupthink about what matters and what doesn't statistically for people who
right.
are doing that job.
Yeah.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
So I know how invested you are in the statistical awakening of friends, colleagues, the masses, all of us. You want to aggressively drag us to your.
No, that's not.
I know. No, but I love the way you think about it. I have been a guy who pushes against that for decades in certain ways. And there have been times that I'm a little embarrassed of that. My awakening was a little slow.
Right.
But what I find fascinating is that there are still people within the game who push against it.
Yes.
Sometimes they're managers. Very often they're players. But there are people who push against it and have to do the bidding of the ones who are more powerful. But I think that's part of why I myself and maybe others have pushed for nuance in that conversation sometimes, because, well, what about these guys who are actually doing it, who I ask about, and it matters to them? What am I supposed to do with that?
Right. So, but that's the thing that I think is the rub here, and it even gets into broadcasting. I mean,
of course,
you know, you're
it
not
does.
Gonna name names, but as a general idea, people can't get their head around the idea that there are folks that played the game really well, that don't understand it that well, and that don't know that much. That's just real. And it's like it doesn't compute, and I understand why it doesn't compute, but
wow.
Like, it's just...
But then that gets to a battle of sort of ego power,
yes,
on some level, where those that played it,
yes,
feel like, I don't have to understand it. I'm just good at it.
Well,
who are
that's
you?
Right.
Who are you
that's
to
right.
tell me I'd understand?
Yes, absolutely. But it's the, you know, it's the Dick Vitale. You don't have to have had a heart attack to be a heart surgeon.
Hmm. Oh, that's good. That's a Vitale line?
Yeah.
I love that.
So... Yes, right. They're great. I mean, anyway.
Yes.
Let's talk play-by-play.
Yes.
I don't want to be nerd guy the whole time.
No. You're not nerd guy.
You always make me nerd guy.
Hey, look, if I could tell people the books that are in this room that we're in right now, that would not help your nerd guy fight if you're looking to undefine yourself.
There it is. There's that book, The Statistical Awakening of Taylor McGregor.
Well, I didn't know that Keith Law wrote this many books. You know what I mean?
All right.
They're all up here.
Stop it.
So who was there a moment as a kid where you're like, man, I want to do that? Do you have a moment? And maybe it's a little older. I don't know when it was for you. And I'm curious if there was a specific voice or a specific play-by-play person that got you there, and maybe you aspired to that specifically. But however your origin story starts in your mind, what is it?
I would say my origin story starts as sort of, I love baseball. You know, I've told the story a million times. I was six, and my grandparents went on a cruise, and I didn't understand what a cruise was, so they explained what a cruise was to me. And they sat there. My grandfather told me, you know, we leave, giant boat, gambling, dancing, drinking, eating. And when he finished, all I asked was, how do you get the box scores? And he was like, you don't. And I said, well, I'm not going. So I just loved it. I loved the sport. I wanted to play. So I can't say, you know, my fantasy was to play. Harry Callis was the voice. So, like, Harry, who was the
Michael Jack Schmidt, number 500.
Yeah, the voice of the Phillies. And then
Paul Malls. Paul Malls Straits.
Right. And then he did some NFL films, you know, filling in for John Facenda. And, yeah, so that was the voice. Born in Philadelphia, moved to New York. But, like, that's the voice. And then, I don't know, just as a kid, I wasn't a shy kid, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, my dad had had and has tape recordings of me as a kid just kind of talking and hamming it up. There was a performative component to it. I will say that as it went on, I don't think I knew that I wanted to be a play-by-play guy. I was probably, not probably, I was more interested in being talk radio guy. But baseball was always my absolute love.
So that scale, in my mind, I have a scale of how, you know, where your starting point might be to become a play-by-play person. So Benetti started with the technical and nailed the technical and then let his personality bloom. I, in my 50s, have the personality part down as a talk show host and an entertainer. And then I've fought hard to try and learn the technical. So as you talk about it and you dreamed of talk show host, it sounds like maybe you started personality and then added the technical.
So I did the talk radio and then I was kind of obsessed with learning the technical. I thought the technical was really hard. So I would go to Marlins games and sit in an empty broadcast booth and do games into a tape recorder. And then when I felt like I had a good enough tape, I gave it to some people.
Did you listen to your tape early on? Did you listen to yourself and dissect yourself?
I will say that the best, you know, in the early years, the best advice that I got that I still give to people, and it's hard to do because you're anxious and antsy and you want, but if you're going to listen to yourself, don't listen the day after or right after the game. Try and wait like 2 weeks so that you can at least give yourself a bit of the experience that the actual viewer or listener has. Because if you're listening to yourself in this anticipatory, okay, this is where I'm about to say this, you're not really experiencing it the way the listener. And then what you find is you're not as bad, or it wasn't as bad in that spot as you thought it was. It wasn't even as good as you thought it was in the spots where you really nailed it. So I would go do games in a tape recorder. Eventually, I got a job. My buddy Dan Lebatard connected me with one of his college friends who was doing games in Sioux City, and that team owned another team in Boise, Idaho. I got a job short season A, and then it was kind of off from there. But it was the mechanical stuff that it definitely flummoxed me. I didn't think I was very good. And I had a hard time with it. And I will say that after a couple years, I gave a tape to John Miller, and he gave me the best piece of technical advice that I'd ever gotten. It's still the thing that I help young broadcasters with, and it's radio advice. But it's so brilliant, and it helps so much. And I'll remember to tag. You know, I've told John this a million times, but he had a funny line one time recently when I told him how much he had helped me. But his big emphasis was being on time and utilizing the sounds in the ballpark. But his big emphasis was, as a play-by-play guy, you want to tell people that the play is beginning. And the play begins when the pitcher pitches the ball. So that, and what he was, again, his opinion. Now, I'll interrupt and say, I think after Vin, John is probably as good as there's ever been. Mechanically, telling stories, all of it. But his technical advice was, tell people the play is beginning. So you want, here's the pitch, here's the 2-2, kicks and fires, every time if you can. And if the batter swings, give him motion. So you don't want the 3-2 hit on the ground. You want swing and a ground ball. But the biggest piece of advice that he gave that was so sensational was, you want to say, here's the pitch or here's the 2-2 before you think you do. So that if you try with Kyle Hendricks to say, here's the pitch, as his arm is releasing the ball, the ball's faster than your voice.
Yeah, you're late.
So as you're saying that TCH in pitch, the ball's hitting the mitt. So his point is, you kind of, you know, as his arm is starting to come around, that's where you want to say, here's the pitch, so that you can use the sounds. Because in a well-mic'd park, it should sound like, here's the pitch. In there for a strike. Nothing in one. Or it hits the bat. So there should be a little... So for me, if I listen to a radio highlight, I want space. I want to hear, here's the 2-2, space, crack, swing and a high fly ball, deep left field. That's what I want to hear every time. And then the other part of that advice is that it puts you on time. If you do that, if you say, here's the pitch, a tiny bit before you think you need to, you're less likely to chase the play. And if you do play-by-play, you understand what I'm like. Chasing the play is you're just behind and you're trying to stuff, you know, 4 pounds into a 2-pound bag because you're late. So it was just amazing. And even today, you know, I mainly do TV now, and I'll go over and do a Sunday night game on the radio, or I get to the postseason and it can feel fast. And then I'll just slow it down, and it's...
You probably got to be even earlier on radio, don't you?
Well, I'm talking about radio mainly. Yeah. So, on the radio, you're just focusing on the pitcher, you know what I mean? So you're just... You may leave out some other stuff, and, you know...
All right, I want to follow up on this, but what was John Miller's tag when you talked to him about it, and you told him how much it helped you?
Oh, my timing's been bad lately. Probably want to remember to do that some more. It was something to the effect of, I forgot I had told you that. You know what? That's really good advice. I gotta mix that in tonight.
Oh, that's so beautiful. So I heard a version of that from Joe Davis, which I thought about as I did my three games, which was, and he heard it from Miller. Which was, and you mentioned it in there, but all I got from Joe was, use the pop of the mitt and or the crack of the bat as part of the cadence of your call.
Yes.
And I adored that, and that helped kind of guide me. Joe Buck, who's like the first person I ever really talked about, well, him and Len Casper are the first people I ever really talked about the gig in this kind of detail with. Buck told me, the pitch is the star. Never lose sight of the pitch. All have different ways to say, here comes the pitch. And the 2-1, he fires, like all that kind of thing. So I thought about those two things, like, all right, if that's the basis of how I do it, great. But what you just gave me is so massively helpful to make sure you say, here's the pitch, earlier than you think. Because I was playing catch up all 3 days. I felt at different times I was playing catch up. And if that little trick gets you on time and frees you up to do everything else.
To the point, and I don't want this to freak you out, but I would say that this will happen to me absolutely, where you want to be ahead enough so that this will happen to me. Hendricks will go regular signs. Looks in, says yes. And the 2-2. Nope, won't be made. Throws to first. Like, you're that trying to be that far ahead. So, like, sometimes you see him start to move, and you're starting to say, here comes the, and he throws to first, and you just say, no,
he throws over.
It's fine.
That dovetails with your experience in the park. You're waiting for the pitch, and then right. The guy throws to first.
Yeah.
You know? So that's okay.
Yeah.
Boy, incredibly helpful. All right, so yeah. I love what you say, like, look, yeah, sometimes I do radio or get to the postseason. Voice of the World Series on the radio. Voice of the All-Star Game on the radio. But as you say, you're doing so much TV. You can be, I know you don't choose to be, but you can be sloppier on TV.
Yeah, and I would say this. I think COVID stunk. I'm happy too, and have had many people say, I loved you on Korea Baseball. But we're sitting in our apartment talking over games, and it became a little more podcasty.
Sure.
And I think it made me a little worse. I do. I feel... Yeah, so... Yes, you can be sloppier. I think sometimes I'm guilty of it.
Yeah, but you're talking about doing the Korea games, and I watched some of those, especially when you and Benetti worked together. I thought those were so cool. But
that was magic.
Yeah, wasn't it?
Yes.
You could tell it was.
I don't know where the Emmy is, but it better be coming.
But that's you're watching on TV, and you can't read stuff.
Well, the best thing with that, too, I mean, I was in my apartment in New York City in the middle of the pandemic, and these games would be at 4:30, 5:30 Eastern time, 4:30 in the morning.
In the morning, yeah.
So I would get up at either 2 or at 3 and do my prep. But then this would happen. It happened probably 4 times. 10 minutes before the broadcast, you get a phone call. Hey, I know you were going to do the Kiwoom Hanwha game, but it got rained out. So in 10 minutes, you're going to do the NC Dinos and the Lotte Giants. And the first time that Phil Orland said that to me, I was kind of like, oh, that's funny, Phil. Oh, no, I'm serious. Okay, wait, what? There's a game starting in 10. I didn't know the other two teams very well to begin with. Now there's two new teams?
That's absurd.
So it was. And then you'd have people tweeting at you, do the play-by-play. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like, you had to make it fun. So you, that autopilot that kicks in, whether it's radio or TV play-by-play,
yeah,
clicks off a little bit, or clicked off then for me. You know, you're sort of just accenting what you're seeing, but it was like I said, it was like log rolling and juggling chainsaws. It was what the experience was like, because you were a prisoner to whatever camera shots they showed.
Sure.
So you'd be in the middle of a conversation and there's that guy. And you know what I mean? So it just became... Yeah, we had fun.
It sounds like it.
We had fun, but I also would say,
I don't think it made you worse.
I feel like it did.
It probably made you. It made you more loose on some levels and more into the fun and the entertainment.
Well, I think that
because you are now, because that comes across like you and JD and whoever. If it's Sutcliffe, you have obviously a great relationship with him. There's a sense of play.
Yes,
that is massively important over 160 times.
That's so. The one thing I'll say is back to what you talked about in terms of the origin story.
Yeah,
that's 5-year-old me. Like, that's who I am. I'm someone who just likes to play. It's the way when I get to the ballpark and people engage me on the concourse, people that are working at Wrigley, or I like to play, man. I just do.
Yeah.
It's just my sort of my natural state. I will say that one of the really cool things, and again, just my assessment, is I think I got better like 39, 40, 41, which is something I would not have anticipated, but I did, in my opinion, because I just think I delivered the most authentic version of me. Like, the biggest thing you're trying to do is I'm holding my left hand out all the way to the left and then my right hand out to the right. You're trying to take what you're like off the air and what you're like on the air, and you're trying to make them as close together as possible. That's what you're trying to do.
Hell yeah.
And
I can tell you that's the same for broadcasters of any kind. At least my aspiration, yes, as a talk show host has always been to remove as much artifice as I can between myself and the microphone.
I tried to do it doing ESPN games when it's still a little more formal, you know. I think local TV, there's normally more space for it, but I still think you want to deliver. Look, the best example I could give you in 3 years working for the Cubs of what I'm talking about is an example that I could give you for my partner, and that is doing a game remotely, tight shot, Ryan Tepera. I audibly say, hmm. And JD says, what? And I said, I'm trying to figure out who Ryan Tepera looks like. And JD says, he kind of looks like my cousin Randy. But here's the point. For so long in this business, we've been programmed to, you can't say that. That's not serious. But that's the thing that if he and I were sitting on the couch watching,
100%.
That we would say, and it would make me roar. So I think that that's the part and the sensibility that he and I share. You're just getting the two of us hanging out. There's a lot of stuff where, and it's a wonderful feeling, but there's a lot of stuff where when JD and I reference things, I'm saying, okay, was that on the air or was that off the air? And then I think we're in a good space.
Oh, that's beautiful. All right. Well, before I started doing the pod, I had a big list of questions that I thought I would use as a thread through for every interview.
Some of them stunk.
Yeah, I know, right? Fun fact, folks, I sent them all to John Boogshambi, who gave me some feedback. Some of them did stink, and they've been excised. Some of them stay, and then you gave me a couple that I have enjoyed. So now I get to throw them at you. These are questions you fed me, pal. All right, question one that Boog suggested I ask other people. But
so, I'm so screwed if my answers suck. I mean, my answers have sucked, but in this instance.
Well, yeah, pressure's on. This is clutch. You got to come up clutch, or at least the absence of choke, if you can. Mm-hmm. What is one part of your game prep that you can't ignore? Like, I have to do this before every single game.
Yeah, the starting point, it's funny. I talk with Pat about it, but if you make me prepare for a game, the first thing that I'm going to do is where do the Cubs rank today in the National League and in the majors, in runs per game, in homers, in on base, and in slug, and where do they rank in ERA, starters ERA, relief ERA, and strikeout rate overall, and then the same thing for the Braves.
Like it. Who is the person that helped you the most? Anyone, family or in the business, when you think about this career?
I'll go two parts. I think, Dave O'Brien was one of the first guys that critiqued my tape and has always been kind of a big brotherish type guy who's helped me a lot. And then I still would have to say that because of what John Miller gave me in terms of that technical advice, and has always been willing to talk and share thoughts.
That's awesome. Would you say, this is my follow-up, if you don't mind, my own follow-ups in the middle of your questions. Mm. Would you say that there is, in general, kind of an inclusive sensibility of, like, offering to help and share within the broadcasting community?
I would say so. I think there's a pay-it-forward type vibe. I mean, I try as much as I can. I have a sort of a cue right now, but if somebody says they do play-by-play, I'll offer to listen and critique it.
Yeah. Did you ever doubt that you would be good enough to do it at the highest level?
Yeah, for sure. 100%. I remember doing the games in Boise, and I was just like, this is hard. Because it's that classic, the sport is really slow, and then it gets fast all of a sudden. And that's the thing that's so challenging about doing the play-by-play. And all of the reps and the words just fall out of your mouth. And your brain just activates in a way. But yeah, I had doubt that I would be able to do it well. And then doubts that I would, be able to improve on that when I got there.
Mm-hmm. And that personal maturity that you were talking about at 39 or 40, at 41, you feel like that helped you get over a final hump on some level? See, my follow-ups are bad.
I can't.
They are.
I can't say. I mean,
I get all in my feelings, Boog.
No, but I can tell you that I genuinely felt like, wow, I don't know if I'm good enough at this when I was doing Boise. I just kept doing it and practicing and trying to get better.
Yeah. Well, here, let's follow up with another one of yours. What's the last time you were nervous before a broadcast? You told me to ask this.
I think...
Blame yourself, pal.
Yeah. I think I might have been nervous before Cubs... Before my first Cubs spring training game. Maybe opening day of 21. Definitely a little bit for... Shulman got laryngitis, and I called the clincher of Game 5 of the World Series on national radio in 2018.
Wow.
And I was a little... But not in any... Just sort of the butterflies. It's cool.
Those are fun, though,
yeah.
Right? Was it a good game?
Yeah, it was... The Red Sox scored every run on a homer.
Oh, was it the clincher?
Was it the clincher.
It was the extra inning game where... Where you,
no, it was the clincher.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so Sale finishing.
Yes.
Sale again looks in. He's ready. Turns, kicks, fires. Swing and a miss. It is over. The Boston Red Sox, baseball's best all season long. They have won it all. And a celebration begins. They mob Chris Sale. And the dog pile starts third base side of the pitcher's mound. For the fourth time in the last 15 years, the Red Sox are World Series champions.
So you got to call the Red Sox clinching the World Series.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was cool.
That's pretty large. A lot of that team is back together in L.A., huh? J.D. Martinez and Mookie Betts.
Yeah, yeah.
Joe Kelly.
Yep.
Funniest interaction with a player. I know you've had a lot of them. You love them. You adore it.
So I love that.
I know
mean,
you do.
It's got to be the Chipper Jones story.
Oh, yeah. I think I know you've told me personally, but yeah, no, tell me here.
Yeah, it's I'm pretty fortunate to be able to. I feel like I've had a ton of them, just because my thing is you're trying to humanize the players. So my 3 years that I did the Atlanta Braves on television was a blast. Chipper was a lot of fun. He was amazing to watch. He's a savant. You know, he's one of those guys. Like, some players think they know and remember stuff. Chipper knows and remembers. He's the only... I would sit there with the batter-pitcher matchups. You know, this is like 07. And you'd get batter-pitcher matchups, and you'd be like, hey, AJ Burnett, do you know whether you're good against him? And some guy would be like, I think I see the ball pretty good against him. It's like, you're 0 for 15 with 12 punch-outs. But Chipper was always like... How are you against Sean Markham? No at bats, but I did homer on a changeup in spring training 3 years ago. You know, like stuff like that. So anyway,
wow.
2008, I believe, it was the year I think Chipper won the batting title. It's August. We're in San Diego. And there's a video clip of this that I retold it and it went viral. And my partner in the booth is Rossi.
Oh.
And we had Chipper in the booth for it.
That's so good.
But the story is Chipper had not been swinging the bat particularly well. And he'd been swinging at the first pitch a lot and been rolling over to second a lot. And so I went on FanGraphs and I noticed that he saw the second fewest first pitch strikes by percentage in the majors. And I asked him, why do you keep swinging at the first pitch? You don't get very many strikes.
He had 368.
I know, but I wasn't like, I'm just asking.
He had an OBP of 470 in 2008, Book. Who the hell are you?
But I'm not, I wasn't, I don't, everybody takes it that way. I was simply asking, I was presenting information. I was not saying don't swing it. I was just, please, it was for him, honestly, for him, it was like putting coins in a machine when you would present stuff like this to him.
Yeah.
And so he would say to me, or he said to me that day, because it's probably the only time in the whole at bat I'm going to get a fastball. So I'm hunting a fastball. That's why I do it. So we continue the conversation, and then they have to go take batting practice. So the conversation kind of stops. It doesn't actually conclude. And that night in the first inning, he's hitting third. First two guys make an out. He's facing Tim Stauffer, former first-round pick, with not particularly good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And... Chipper digs in, and the first pitch from Tim Stauffer is like 90 or 91, and it splits the plate with a crappy fastball, and he steps out of the box and looks up at me like, see, asshole, that's why I swing at the first pitch. And then he digs back in and, like, shakes his head. He ended up walking. But then when he told the story with me and Rossi, he said,
if you had any clue as to what was the language that was going around in my head gosh. Right there, because I let you dictate the bat right there.
Yeah,
you
know? The Hall of Famer, right?
And, yes. Right and,
the by the way, I walked him at it bat, if you're wondering. We came back from down 0-1, and we ended up walking, and we were left stranded. And I got some more as he came off the field. He's waving at me. Which is incredible. The guy who's a Hall of Famer,
sure.
And he's up there, and he's like, should I be swinging the first pitch? I don't know if I should be swinging the first pitch. So
you got in his head for one at bat.
Amazing. And, like, I have a frozen picture of him looking up at me in the broadcast booth. It's just, yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful.
If you Google, if you put Boog and Chipper on Twitter or on Instagram, you can find it anywhere.
Well, maybe eventually that search will lead them to this episode of the PBP Voices of Baseball.
I love that.
Where they would hear it as part of a broader conversation. It's perfect. Boog, you affected the podcast greatly. Not just with the questions, as interacted about a year ago or whatever it was, but right here, this kind of conversation is what I want this thing to be. So thank you.
Thanks for having me, brother.
Bye, bro. Amazing. Boog, with the understandable arrogance to say, we walked in that at bat. Him and Chipper. So much good stuff in there, in my opinion, in that conversation about getting to use your brain, about engaging the conversation in the back of your head. And maybe most of all, for me, the forced mindfulness. You know I love that. Benetti and I talked about that in the first episode that I did with Jason. But Boog put it in a wonderful way. 3 hours where you're just being asked to be there. And it's an incredibly beneficial thing in his life to actually be there. The mindfulness that I was able to experience doing the games, I've been able to kind of carry it with me a little bit. I try to turn off my phone more during a radio show or during something that I really should be focusing on. And baseball, again, and still offering really good lessons, even at this point in my life and career. Okay, next week, Howie Rose, the radio voice of the Mets, who started a Marv Albert fan club at the age of 13. You'll hear that story, among many others, in a great conversation I really enjoyed. My producer here on the PBP, Voices of Baseball, is Ryan Porth. My collaborator is James Vickery. The theme music comes from the great Kurt Morrison of Tributosaurus. Find the PBP, Voices of Baseball, in the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts. From 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball, the PBP, Voices of Baseball. I'll bring you the people who bring you the game.